The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Wiggerson, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. Let's run through the announcements and then on to our program today. For those of you who are going to want to call us, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. No call, screeners, let it ring until it can be answered. We'll bring you up on the air. And again, for those of you outside the U.S., if your country recognizes toll-free numbers, it is an MCI number, so you would contact your in-country MCI operator, and that person should be able to complete your call. If you do not recognize toll-free numbers and you want to call, unfortunately, it's a toll call for you, but email me and I'll send you the regular phone number so that you can do country code, area code, and number and come in on the same line. Also, do remember that we do take email from the listeners, and that address for today is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then also, we're copyrighted and trademarked. You do have permission to download shows and share them and to distribute them in the MP3 format. Please, nothing commercial. Don't edit any of the programs, and please don't do written transcripts, even if they're for your personal use. And special thanks goes to Andrew over at gigadial.net. He does our podcasting. You'll find our podcasting RSS URLs on our website, both of our newsletters, if you want to subscribe to our podcast. And then again, we're in iTunes, Podcast Alley, Zune, yastro.com, astrospacenow.com, and a host of other places as well. And then do go to our website. You'll find the comprehensive newsletter that is there. It's uploaded after the Sunday program into Sunday evening sometime, California time. It has all of the details of the guest bios. It has the future section of what's planned for the space show coming up. It's the only place you'll find that. And if we have to change a program or make an announcement, the website newsletter is where you'll see it first. And you can also, from this location, subscribe to the email newsletter, which is very, very short. It goes out early Monday morning about the week's activities. Everything we do is archived, and you can hear them right off of our website, or you can easily download these shows, and you can use the guest search tool on our website to see who all the guests have been and what the date was that they were on the show, and then you can go to that date and listen to that show. There's a Space Show store on the website. You'll see it up at the top called Space Show Gear. And then again, the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with One Giant Leap Foundation.org. And this program does not exist without your support. Your support is crucial. And if you pay U.S. taxes, you do get a tax donation. And if you're paying California taxes, you also get a state of California tax deduction as well. If you have any questions on that, do email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. I'm more than happy to, I have one more announcement that I should read, and that is that we're partially sponsored by the Secure World Foundation. I say this on every show, and we're deeply appreciative of their support. They promote cooperative solutions for space security, and you can learn quite a bit more about their activities. Do visit their website, secureworldfoundation.org. And then I'm really happy to bring back to you one of our frequent guests. Dr. Eric Seedhouse is with us. He has a brand new book called Trailblazing Medicine, Sustaining Explorers During Interplanetary Missions. This one is published by Springer. And Eric Seedhouse is an aerospace scientist whose ambition has always been to work as an astronaut. After completing his first degree in sports science at Northumbria University, he joined the Legacy 2nd Battalion of the Parachute Regiment, the world's most elite airborne unit. And during his time in this unit, Eric spent 6 months in Belize, where he was trained in the art of jungle warfare and conducted several border patrols along the Belize-Guatemala border. Later, he spent several months learning the intricacies of desert warfare on the Arkhamis Range in Cyprus. He's made more than 30 jumps from a C-130, performed more than 200 abseils from a helicopter, and fired more light anti-tank weapons than he cares to remember. Just running through some of all of this, he is an athlete of great proportions. And in addition to that, he has worked at Bigelow Aerospace, and he was an astronaut training consultant for them. He has written books on tourism in space as well as other subjects. He is a member of the Aerospace Medical Association, and he's up in Canada. So his new book, Trailblazing Medicine, I have it in front of me, is a book that you should be looking at and getting if you're interested in aerospace medicine that is comprehensive and easy to understand. It's not a medical textbook like you might get if you were in medical school. Eric, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Okay, thanks, Dave. It's great to be back. Thanks for inviting me.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. Did you watch the last shuttle flight?
Not live, but I watched it on NASA TV.
Any reflections, thoughts that you'd care to share with us?
Well, I just think it's it was a sad day because the space shuttle is a symbol. And looking down the pipeline in terms of the vehicles that are being developed now, there's nothing really that looks as iconic as a shuttle. And I think that's just a shame because it could have been flown for another 10, 15 years, just like the astronauts said when they were interviewed. There's nothing wrong with the technology. Obviously, it is very, very expensive. But, I mean, the budget, that's not even the air conditioning budget for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So in terms of the cost perspective, there's not much argument there.
We spend more on potato chips and junk food than what we do on the space shuttle.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's another perspective. There's tons of articles on the cost of obesity in the United States, and it's far more than what we spend on shuttle flights a year. And you're right. Air conditioning in Afghanistan and Iraq is far more than what we're spending on NASA and the space shuttle. But I guess it's more important. I don't know. Space medicine. I hope that we're around to see it all be applied and to get us back into space. But that's not really the subject of today's show, but it is a concern with a lot of people here. How come you decided to write this book? I mean, there are no shortages, for example, of space medicine books, experts, papers from AIAA and elsewhere. So a little background to the book, okay?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big science fiction fan, and people who watch Aliens and films like that, Moon, The Sunshine, films like that will be familiar with science like human hibernation and nanotechnology. But I think people will be surprised that this is actually a subject of research happening right now. For example, the European Space Agency is conducting research as we speak into human hibernation. And what I wanted to do, as you mentioned, this has been written about in medical textbooks, but it hasn't been written at the lay level. What I wanted to do was to synthesize that information and make it understandable to a lay audience. And so basically what this book describes, it looks at the future of space medicine, probably the near future in the next 3 or 4 decades, and how it relates to human space exploration, and then describes what is necessary or what will be necessary to keep a crew alive to a distant location such as Mars or the outer planets.
Well, we hear a lot of talk about we need to go to Mars or we're going to do a flyby by a NEO. That seems to be part of the policy, although it's not really funded. You know, some talk still about going back to the moon. So to stay, they always say to stay, right? Are we on the medical side capable of doing this? And if you were sitting here next to Bob Zubrin, When he was last on the show, I don't know if you got to hear it or not, but he was extremely critical of aerospace medicine doctors and the flight surgeons for studying, and just coming up with reasons why to study more and to not do anything. And he said all we have to do is spin the capsule this way or that way, and we don't need to know precisely how much microgravity a human needs, because even if we spin it at lunar gravity or Martian gravity, it's better than no gravity. So there's a lot of people who do believe and think that that's a good approach. I mean, most of the aerospace medicine people I talk to sort of scoff at all that, but are we able to go to Mars today with what we know about the medical side, the human factor side of space medicine?
Probably not, because right now we're looking at a six-month mission. But if we get Vladimir, if that's proven, then we get there in 35 days, and that's more achievable. But if we're looking at technology today, and if we were to go to Mars and it was going to take us 6 months, then you're taking a big risk, because there is no set radiation limit. I have to say a career limit for outer space. NASA sets radiation career limits for astronauts in low Earth orbit, where they're protected from most of the bad radiation. But going to Mars, you're going to be hit by a much more severe radiation, and they really don't know how that's going to affect them. And right now, although we do have countermeasures that we can use, such as polyethylene shielding, even that is not sufficient to protect astronauts for 6 months in deep space. So that's why I actually addressed it in the book. So there are other countermeasures that will be available near term, such as nanotechnology, for example, a basculoid, which is something that's actually installed into the body, which can actually help repair damage, for example, cell repair machines. If anybody's familiar with nanotechnology, this is happening right now. They're actually developing cell repair machines. You infuse a few hundred million units of these devices into the body, and then when the DNA strands are broken by the radiation, en route to Mars, the cell repair machines go in and repair the damage. But right now, with the technology that we have now, you're basically looking at a very risky proposition.
So that technology is on the drawing board, but not operationally proven today. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct, yes.
It sounds like pretty good technology if we can do it. Well, what are the facts on what we need for gravity to sustain? I guess to sustain the human body without deterioration. I guess that's the guideline, right? Because you're not looking to create an exact replica of Earth. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. Originally, if you remember, the International Space Station was supposed to have had an artificial gravity module.
Right.
And they actually built it, and they were going to fly it, and then because of the cutbacks, they weren't able to fly it. So now it's sitting in a parking lot in Japan somewhere, gathering dust. But now, because they want to use the International Space Station as a platform for human sciences research, amongst other things, to enable human exploration beyond low Earth orbit, they're actually looking at putting an artificial gravity or a centrifuge on the space station. So in terms of that, I think they've resurrected the research at Wiley Labs, because they used to do a lot of artificial heat research. They have something called the short radius centrifuge down in Wiley, where they experiment with zero gravity and reducing the effects of zero gravity on humans by spinning people around in the centrifuge to determine what is the optimum revolutions per minute. And they really haven't decided what is the best RPM to get the adaptive effect, because if you spin people too fast, they get Coriolis effects and they feel sick. If you spin them too slow, then they don't get the sufficient gravity, so they don't get the effect to offset bone demineralization. What I've read in the research, the optimum RPM seems to be around 4 to 6. That's where you get the adaptive effect. You can tolerate that, and it also helps with offsetting bone demineralization. So what you would do with the spacecraft, if you were to send a spacecraft to Mars with a centrifuge on board, you'd actually install the sleeping quarters in the centrifuge. So you actually sleep in the centrifuge as you're going to Mars.
Why short arm instead of long arm?
Well, it's just because of the cost. If you, like, even the short arm centrifuge, you're looking at about 14-foot diameter module. And obviously you don't want to make it too big, because then you have a problem with putting on the spacecraft. It's just it becomes a cost issue.
But you have more susceptible problems to motion with the short arm, right?
Yeah, they I think they have problems beyond 6 RPM. I know that at a spin rate of 2 RPM, they don't have any problems. So it's between 2 and 4 RPM. But that's not the only solution. I mean, there was a guy in NASA, I think, called Houston. He actually designed a spacecraft that would spin at a rate of 4 RPM. So basically, you spin the spacecraft. And I think the guy, Kent Houston, that was his name. It's a NASA engineer who actually designed the spacecraft to spin. And so basically, just spin the spacecraft at 4 RPM, and off you go. And there's your solution right there.
And that assumes that 4 RPM provides you enough gravity to mitigate the problems, correct?
I think that provides you with about 0.4, 0.5 of a gravity of 1G.
I've also seen some ideas for tethers for artificial gravity. But we're dragging our feet. Why isn't anything implemented? Is it just all because of cost? Or, I mean, this seems to be such basic and important work. Why doesn't something get implemented?
Well, because they don't really have a mandate to go anywhere right now. I mean, right now the mandate is to stay in low Earth orbit for another decade or so. The only tentative plan is to go to this near-Earth asteroid, and that's really not going to be that much of a journey. So until we decide to go, you know, significantly beyond low Earth orbit, then there's no real impetus to do all this research. I mean, it's still being done. I mean, Wiley is still conducting artificial gravity research, and the European Space Agency, as I mentioned, is looking at hibernation. But, I mean, there's not a lot of money behind these research efforts.
So I guess the bottom line question is, why do we not have a goal to go anywhere, assuming that destinations are important? Because, again, I have a lot of guests on the show who believe that NASA and the space program should not be destination-oriented.
Well, I think the way commercial space is going, I think the ultimate Mars mission, or when we finally go to Mars, I think it may be a commercially funded enterprise. I don't think it will be a government enterprise anymore.
Well, they're going to need this information to go safely, assuming safety is one of their priorities, right?
Well, they will. But right now, I think they're diverting funds to research that isn't that necessary. For example, the European Space Agency, Mars 500, research where they locked cosmonauts in a habitat for 500 days to simulate a Mars mission. That really isn't very helpful. That money could have been much better spent on radiation protection or bone demineralization studies, because we really know an awful lot about behavioral problems.
Here's your first question of the day, and this is Alex is in Chicago. And Alex says, can you group the primary classification of space medicine issues for long-duration spacecraft? You've mentioned gravity, for example, and radiation. What are the other areas where the challenges are pretty serious?
Well, you've got bone demineralization. We know that astronauts who live on board the International Space Station for 6 months come back and they have lost almost 10% of their bone mass. Also, the longer you spend in space, the more bone mass you lose. So, these astronauts, they exercise religiously. They spend 2 to 3 hours every day exercising to try and prevent this bone demineralization. They're fanatical about doing the countermeasures which they're prescribed. And even with all those countermeasures, even with all the nutritional interventions, everything, after all that, they still come back to Earth and they have lost almost 10% of their bone mass. For example, Thomas Reiter, who's a European Space Agency astronaut who went up in 1995, he lost just over 10% of his bone mass. And 10 years later, he had only just recovered that bone mass. So you imagine going to Mars, a six-month trip. You step off the bottom rung of a ladder, and your tibia snaps. That's not a good start to a mission. So bone demineralization is very high up there, just as you said, with radiation. A lot has been said about behavioral issues. I would argue that is not a problem, because you have a huge wealth of information that comes from polar exploration and Antarctic exploration. 100 years ago, these guys went off and spent 3-4 years in the Arctic. They had no faxes, no email, no Twitter accounts or anything like that, and they survived very well. So I'd say bone demineralization, radiation, and probably those are the two big ticket items.
What about the muscle deterioration, or do you put that in with the bone?
I put that in with the bone. It's less of a concern. You're spending 2 to 3 hours exercising every day. You still see a degradation in muscle tone and also the an atrophying of the muscles, but that's less serious than the actual bone demineralization.
I did a show a couple of weeks ago with two researchers who have a NASA grant on psychological and behavioral issues, and one of my fellow professors at the University of North Dakota, Vadim Regalov, actually worked on the mental side on the long-duration mirror crew problems that they were having. What I'm told by these guys are that the reason why this, and I'd like your comment on this, the space side is so different than what happened on missions here on Earth or submarines even or something like that, is twofold. Number one, they disassociate with Earth when they're 4 to 6 months in space. And since none of them have gone further than LEO, they haven't had to deal with the communication gaps that are going to take place, so that you can't have a normal conversation with your family members or girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever when you're ending up with 15, 20-minute gaps in communication. So they're trying to figure out how to redesign communication packets to keep people connected. But the disassociation from Earth, they say, makes a huge difference from these problems that people have had, like Shackelford and submarines and other things like that. And, of course, these people work in that field, so obviously this is their interest, right? So your thoughts on this?
Well, I just think we've become soft because, as I mentioned before, the golden era of exploration 100 years ago, expeditions were sent to the Antarctic, and they had no communication at all. They didn't see their families for 4 years. They didn't have a single letter. They didn't have a single phone call. They didn't have cell phones, no fax machines, no internet, no email, nothing. They were sent into the most hostile environment you can imagine, and probably a lot more hostile than 6 months on a spacecraft. I mean, they spent 4 years in the Antarctic, the long winter nights where it was permanent darkness for 4 or 5 months, minus 40, minus 50 degrees Celsius, howling winds. They had no idea whether they were going to get back. And don't forget, these guys were recruited off the dock. They weren't subject to all the rigorous selection procedures of a government space agency. They were recruited off the dock. They weren't even sure if they were going to get back. And they survived very well. Shackleton's expedition, for example, the Grand Antarctic Expedition in 1914, got all his men back. Nansen, Fridtjof Nansen, who was later awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, he went off for 3 years and brought all his men back. They went into extreme conditions, and they didn't have any psychological problems. There were a couple of fist fights once in a while, but, I mean, they functioned well. They achieved the mission objectives. They came back with fantastic science, and everything went well.
Do you think that we are suited today to repeat a Shackelford type of mission? Or even if you want to go to Antarctic and winter over or something. I know I applied when I was in the Navy, but the screening process and all of what they had even back in the 70s was pretty unbelievable. So they didn't just recruit you off the dock, as you say. I mean, you had to pass all their psychological tests at the time. I'm sure today it's even worse.
Well, I'm talking about 100 years ago.
No, I understand. Do you think today we could repeat those missions?
Well, I think there needs to be more emphasis on leadership, because it's a common denominator in all those missions. Fridtjof Nansen, Ernest Shackleton, Roald Amundsen, all these guys who went into the Antarctic for 3 or 4 years and brought all their men back safely. The bottom line, the common denominator, was strong leadership. And so if you were to survive an incident on the surface of Mars or en route to Mars or on the way back, then it would come down to strong leadership, I think.
Well, so then there's a question of, does NASA train our crews today for that kind of strong leadership? Most everything still comes from NASA control, right?
Well, I don't think they do, because there's no need for it, because they're safe in low Earth orbit. So if something happens, then they just get on the lifeboat, and in a couple of hours, they're back safely on Earth. So there's no real requirement to do that sort of leadership research, because they're not going into an austere environment or a life-threatening environment. Okay, I mean, I know you can argue that low Earth orbit is a life-threatening environment.
No, I know what you mean, for sure. Well, we talk about this all the time in terms of the lack of leadership. I haven't really applied it specifically to what you're talking about, but it makes perfect sense to me. We don't have leadership across the board, from political to financial to policy making to anything. So, you know, and if NASA is awry and confusion, why should their people be any different? You know, they don't seem to be capable of, you know, having leadership. So why should they be able to train in leadership? I don't know the answer to that question, but I think it's a bigger problem than the funding or the engineering or the technical challenges. So,
well, I think they need to take a page out of the military on that one.
Well, but even when they have the military officers on the shuttle or on the space station, their leadership is not really like they are when they're on active duty in the military or in a battlefield situation.
Well, no, but it probably doesn't have to be, because you don't have the same problems that you would have if you went on an expedition to or a more dangerous expedition.
So, what about, I've heard things like we need to prophylactically remove your gallbladder if you're going to go to Mars, or do something to mitigate against, say, kidney stones or something, you know, areas that would be really hard to treat and that are pretty common in people. What do you do for people if they do have these problems? Can you surgically intervene? Can you do something to help them? Could we do it in LEO, or would we just have to pack them up and get them out on the lifeboat?
Well, I think there's a case. I think the common consensus, and I spoke with a couple of flight surgeons, is that appendectomy, pre-mission appendectomy, is probably a good thing. In fact, I think there were a couple of countries that actually implemented that for Antarctic expeditions. So I think it was Australia used to do that. So if you were part of an Australian Antarctic expedition, then one of the requirements was that you had an appendectomy before you went. And it makes sense if you're going to go on a six-month expedition to Mars to have that. Maybe not so much the gallbladder, but an appendectomy, definitely, because if you have appendicitis en route and need it treated, then all sorts of complications, even on Earth, it's bad enough to try and do an appendectomy or treat appendicitis on Earth, but to try and do that in zero-G, there's really not enough experience to do that. I mean, to actually do that, you'd actually probably need to drain the contents of the stomach through a tube if you had the inflammation that's associated with appendicitis, and trying to do that in a confined environment of zero G would be pretty challenging, even for the best surgeon. And then if you had the complication of sepsis, in which bacteria enter the blood and infect the other parts of the body, then you have a serious complication. And for an astronaut on the route to Mars, that would probably be a death sentence. So that's a powerful argument for removing the appendix, I think.
The gallbladder is not as imperative?
Well, from talking to flight surgeons, they put that next on the list. It's probably not obligatory, but the appendix is. And I guess you could offer them the option of the gallbladder.
Another question from you. This is Linda in Berkeley. That's near me, of course. And Linda says, I don't yet have your book. However, one of the questions that always comes up on either space settlement issues or long-term flights, say, to Mars, is the issue of pregnancy. So assuming that a Martian crew is a mixed crew, and assuming that human nature is what it is, what happens with somebody who is pregnant, and how do you prevent that ahead of time if that is something you want to avoid on the mission? Does birth control work in space? Do we have any information on that? Or what would happen with a pregnancy on a mission to Mars?
Well, for that you need a bioethics manual. And a couple of years ago, NASA actually appointed its first ethics director. I can't remember his name right now, but he's in charge of formulating a bioethics code. And that's something you need for a trip to Mars. So to get back to the problem of sex in space, as I like to call it, then there aren't really any guidelines. So there are some guidelines for radiation exposure for female astronauts on low Earth orbit missions. Obviously, the problem of radiation causing DNA damage and cell death and chromosomal abnormalities, I mean, that's the reason you don't want to get pregnant in space, because we don't know how radiation is going to affect the DNA. Then there's problems of preeclampsia and gestational diabetes and all sorts of other problems. And then imagine getting pregnant en route to Mars. How do you treat a pregnancy on the surface? I mean, there are no guidelines for this. I mean, do you turn part of the... do you use all the life support equipment to look after the pregnant woman? I mean, do you have an onboard fan kit? Do you have to use... Do you bring along a pregnancy test kit? I mean, what do you do? There's really no guidelines.
Well, and
for that.
And if they made a rule that said you do not get pregnant, how the hell are they going to enforce it? I mean, they can't enforce it in the Navy when they say you're not supposed to, you know, get it on with the mixed crews on the ships, and that always happens. I mean, just saying this is the rule, it can't happen. That, it seems to me if they have a mixed crew, they're going to have to figure out how to deal with these issues.
Well, yeah, and I think the resolution would be termination. So you'd have a protocol for an in-flight termination.
You mean...
What you would use, you'd use... I think there's a synthetic steroid called mifepristone, which is an abortifacient, and as long as that's administered in the first 2 months of pregnancy, then you terminate the pregnancy.
So you'd chemically abort the... I could just see the people going berserk with that if taxpayer dollars were funding the Martian mission.
Well, yeah, but then what are the alternatives, right? I mean...
I agree with you.
Do you bring baby clothes along? I mean, do you bring diapers along? I mean, what happens? Would the person be an alien? Would he be a Martian? How do you categorize this this child?
I don't know, but...
Well, that's it. So there has to be a bioethics manual of some kind. There has to be guidelines there so people know what to do. And then think about the landing. So imagine a pregnant crew member who getting prepared to land on Mars. She's not going to be able to fit in a seat liner. She's not going to be able to withstand the G-forces. Think of all the complications there. So assuming you didn't terminate the pregnancy, she's going to die on landing because the G-forces are probably going to either kill her or kill the baby or kill both.
Or kill both.
Yeah. Which part of the landing vehicle are you going to turn into a daycare center? Are you going to have the astronauts on rotation, 8 hours on, 8 hours off, looking after the baby? I don't think so.
I just know that human nature being the way it is, if they don't prepare for this, it's going to happen if you have mixed crews. So,
well, it's going to happen, and that's why there need to be guidelines, and right now there are no guidelines.
Very, very interesting, all of this. So if you were planning the a real mission to Mars for landing, what would be your priorities? If we look at what your book, and you have a number of the issues here, you know, you talk about the bone issues and surgery and radiation, and you do talk about the bioethics and things like that, but what would be your priorities in planning out the Mars mission? What do we have to tackle, and in what order? Or does it all unfold simultaneously?
No, I think the radiation is probably the biggest dragon out there, to use a Bob Zubrin phrase. But radiation, especially deep space radiation, research that's been going on at Brookhaven Laboratory has shown that there are some big radiation nuclei there that can do a lot of damage, especially if they strike the brain. After radiation, then you're looking at bone demineralization. And then for going on a trip to Mars, we don't have to worry about things like hibernation or anything like that, but we definitely have to look at radiation, bone demineralization, muscle atrophy, and those are probably the two big ticket items, I would say.
Okay, here's a question for you on radiation. Paul in San Diego. And again, Paul and others, we have this push for the toll-free phone number, remember, rather than email. It is 1-866-687-7223. And Paul says, I don't understand the problem with radiation. We know we can shield the capsule, at least, and the life support habitat with either dirt or something similar or water. Therefore, what is the big deal? I can imagine shielding on the surface of Mars is a different issue, but we can certainly protect the crew with dirt or a comparable or water on the way to and from Mars.
Well, no, you can't, because there's some pretty nasty radiation out there that penetrates just about everything. There's the high-energy particles that we have to deal with. There are the solar particle events, which we can't predict, by the way, even though we do have a means of predicting them, but it's usually too late. It's usually an hour after the onset of the solar particle event. The cosmic rays, the galactic sources, those pose a long-term risk for cancer, cataracts, and all sorts of other illnesses. And there's a huge weight penalty if we absolutely want to be able to shield those astronauts. Yeah, sure, once we get to Mars, we can put regolith on top of the habitat and protect astronauts that way. But en route, there's a lot of radiation that can do a lot of damage. Do you imagine a solar particle event, a radiation storm or a solar storm, whatever you want to call it, and you have radiation sickness in the crew, and what do you do? You've got all sorts of physiological effects. You have nausea, vomiting at more severe levels. You've got severe radiation sickness. You've got fever, emaciation, prolonged convalescence. You might have the whole crew incapacitated. So you've got to be able to protect them from that, because otherwise you don't have a mission.
You know, absolutely, radiation is not to be blown off for sure. So you would rate that as the biggest challenge right now?
I would say so, yes.
Okay, Eric, we're a little behind, so we're going to take our first break. And listeners, stay where you are. Back in 3 minutes. And again, we're pushing for the phones over email, 1-866-687-7223. Back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. Today we're talking to Eric Seedhouse. His book, Trailblazing Medicine, Sustaining Explorers During Interplanetary Missions. Eric, during the break, you brought up the issue of the probable need to do some genetic testing. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, yes, we were talking about radiation sickness and we were talking about bone demineralization. Well, there are some people who are more radiation resistant and there are some people who have better bone density. So why not screen for that? Now, of course, right now there's international legislation bars employers from using genetic information. But if you're selecting an interplanetary crew, probably the most unique space crew in history, then I think it'll be a little bit like joining the military. So you'd waive certain individual rights. One of those individual rights would be for genetic testing. So you would genetically test your potential crew members, and you would select those who are most radiation resistant and those with the best bone density.
And
which would preclude women, by the way.
And you also mentioned that more than likely people who do a Mars mission will be coming back because of the radiation. They'd be coming back sterile, both men and women, correct?
That's more than likely. So as part of the pre-mission medical, women would bank eggs and the men would bank sperm. Although those are reproductive age anyway.
And that would all be part of the full disclosure, right?
That would be part of the full disclosure, yes.
Tom is in Tucson, and he says, do any of these issues play any kind of a significant role in the upcoming suborbital tourism market? Are suborbital tourists going to be subject to very many of these problems?
Well, no, because the whole commercial space industry is all based on the bottom line, which is the dollar. So they want to fly as many people as possible. So they want to select in as many people as possible. So I know for Virgin, the people who've gone through the mission, of the medical side of the mission training, I think 93% of those passed the medical. And those are people all the way up to the age of 80. In terms of the medical problems, they haven't really looked at some of the medical problems because we don't have any background in suborbital flight. The last suborbital flight that we had was Al Shepard back in 1961, 50 years ago. We had a couple of X-15 flights, Scott Crossfield. But that's really all the that's all we know about suborbital flight. So what we may see, I think, is orthostatic intolerance. So people will come back and be a little bit discombobulated. And they won't be able to stand straight on the feet. And that's normal after pulling G. I operate the centrifuge here in Canada. And once you've been subject to G, you're a little bit unsteady on your feet. So we may see people being unsteady on their feet when they get back. And we also will see people being motion sick, definitely. People being motion sick because you've got that G, the 3.5 to 4 G pull-up, and you have the insertion into 0 G, and it's a deceleration. That deceleration from 3 to 4 G to 0 G, that's very provocative in terms of making some people very, very sick. And, of course, you've got the re-entry to 5 or 6 G, going back to Earth, and again, that's also a provocative motion for a lot of people. So I think discombobulation, if you want to call it that way, being unsteady on your feet when you get back down, and motion sickness are going to be the two big problems. Well, not problems, but you're going to see that.
So let's expand the space tourism thing since we have the question from the listener. People can go to a Bigelow space station and, say, do anywhere from 3 orbits of Earth to a week or 8 or 9 days on a Bigelow space station. What happens then? What are the generic people like you and me? Well, not you because you're a champion athlete, but, you know, just the normal, you know, Harrys and Sallys. What are they going to be able to tolerate, say, 3 orbits of Earth to a week or maybe 2 weeks max on a Bigelow station?
Well, the medical selection criteria for orbital spaceflight will be very, very different from that for suborbital. I mean, it's going to be pretty close to what's required for an astronaut. If you remember Richard Garriott, I remember going to a presentation in Los Angeles a couple of years ago when he was talking about all the medical procedures he had to have done just for him to qualify as an orbital spaceflight participant. And this is a fit guy. I mean, he's been to the Antarctic. He's been down to the Titanic on Mir, on the submersible. I mean, he's a fit guy, and he had to jump through all sorts of hoops to get qualified, just as a couple of the other spaceflight participants had to do as well. So the medical qualification for orbital tourists is going to be much more rigorous than for suborbital tourists.
So rather than 93% qualifying, do you have an estimate of how many would qualify for orbital tourism?
I would say half of those that went through the Virgin selection would probably qualify for orbital.
So 45, 48% would qualify.
Yeah.
Wow. You have a caller. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
This is John in Atlanta.
Hi there. How you doing?
Pretty good. Well, I guess you've sort of come close to solving the lady's problem there, then. If they're going to come back sterile anyhow, I guess just pre-sterilize them before they leave, and we'll solve that pregnancy problem, huh?
Yeah, right, with federal tax dollars, right.
That way we won't get pro-life people against space or something. At any rate, I want to ask something that's more substantive here. You briefly mentioned the issue of hibernation. I know that was like, you know, a long time, when I was, years ago, they were always discussing the possibility for long-term space flights. We'd have artificially induced hibernation as a possibility. I was wondering, what is medical research, has there been any progress or information about the feasibility or lack thereof in the last 40 years or so on that subject?
Yeah, there has. The European Space Agency is actually doing research into this right now, and what they're looking for is something called a hibernation induction trigger. So when an animal goes into its hibernaculum or stasis suite or whatever you want to call it, its place where it goes to sleep, then there's a hormone that actually initiates hibernation. And obviously in animals this occurs naturally, but in humans we don't have this capability. So what they're looking for is a human hibernation induction trigger. So basically a hormone that you can inject into a human that will make them fall asleep for a long period of time. And so they've been looking at, to do this, they've been looking at animals that hibernate naturally, like Arctic ground squirrels and black bears. And they're looking at the various things that happen to these animals while they're hibernating. So, for example, the Arctic ground squirrel, they hibernate from, I think, early September to late April. So they're asleep for about 6-7 months. And as part of their hibernation, they reduce their body temperature from 37 degrees Celsius to as little as minus 3 degrees Celsius. And so what happens during that time, all the physiological functions slow down. So all the biochemistry, the metabolism, all those sort of things slow down. And so they reduce the energy by about 90% during that time. Now, the problem with human hibernation is the rewarming. It might be, I think the easier thing to do is going to be able to get a human to hibernate. The more difficult thing is going to be able to rewarm them or to bring them back after the hibernation period, because we don't know what happens to the brain or the human brain when it hibernates. So I'm not sure if you're familiar with the film Pandorum.
I think I actually saw it, yes.
Okay, in the film Pandorum, I'm a big science fiction buff, so I include lots of references to science fiction films in the book. In the film Pandorum, the crew awake from stasis, and they're suffering from some sort of psychosis. And that psychosis is called Pandorum, so we're not sure. Impossible to tell until we do more research. We're not sure if there might be some sort of psychosis coming out of hibernation. So it'll be a little bit like coming out of a deep coma. So, for example, there are procedures for people coming out of deep comas. People in comas for months and years in some cases. And there's a very specific procedure for those people. And it's called the Glasgow Coma Scale. And there's some certain questions you have to ask these people, a certain coordination test they have to do before you actually flag them, clear them as being recovered.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the question is, how long would it take somebody coming out, I guess we don't know that yet, to recover to adequate functionality to where they could do things such as land the spacecraft on Mars and carry out their mission? I mean, what kind of shape would they be in after that? That's a day or two later or something, you know? I mean, would they be, within a day or two, would they be fully functional, or would it be take longer than that?
Well, I think it would come down to how long they were hibernating. And then, obviously, you'd probably bring them out of hibernation, and probably the crew medical doctor would be the first person to be brought out of hibernation. And they would be brought out of hibernation about 2 weeks before entry, descent, and landing, because that's a really complex phase of the mission, probably the most dangerous phase of the mission. So you want to be absolutely sure that all the mission crew members are fully functional. So I would say at least 2 weeks.
Well, that would solve, presumably, a lot of the problems that we've been talking about as far as the bone loss, muscle loss issues.
Well, yeah, what you would have, you'd put these people in hibernation. By this time, we'd have nanotechnology, the cell repair machines that I talked about yesterday. Mm-hmm. Earlier. So you'd have these cell repair machines, and while the crew is hibernating en route to their destination, the cell repair machines would go in. If there's any radiation damage, they would repair the DNA strands. If there's any muscle atrophy, they would repair the muscle. And if there's any bone demineralization, the cell repair machines would repair the bone. And then all you have to worry about is recovering from the hibernation period.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's interesting. I guess this nanotechnology, when that gets developed, that's going to have revolutionary effects on Earth medicine as well, I would think.
Well, yeah, there's a whole institute called the... there's a website called the nanomedicine.org, and Robert Freitas and Richard Phoenix, I think, Christopher Phoenix, these are two of the pioneers in nanomedicine right now. And what they're doing sounds like science fiction, but they're actually implementing some of this technology already into medical intervention.
I mean, conceivably, if people had... build up a plaque in the blood vessels, and these nanobots could go in there and eat it up, I guess, or if there's a tumor, it could go in and just surgically attack the tumor and not the healthy cells and all that thing, couldn't they?
That's one of the applications for these cell repair machines, yes.
Absolutely. Awesome. Well, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
All right.
And, listeners, that opens up our phone line again, 1-866-687-7223. How do we know the cell repair machines would work in microgravity?
I'm sure they'd come up with a solution for that. But if they can build a cell repair machine that functions on Earth, then, I guess as an extra precaution, they would probably integrate the hibernaculum into an artificial gravity unit so they'd actually sleep en route. While subject to about 0.4, 0.5 of a G.
How is one put to sleep to hibernate? Are they given medicine like you're going to, be put to sleep for an operation? Or how are you induced into this deep sleep?
Well, that's the problem. So, as I mentioned before, for the animals, there's a hormone, like an opioid, which is... to help the animal go to sleep, and what they're looking at now is a similar hormone that we can use to induce hibernation in humans. So one they're looking at is called DADL, or alloinkephalin, I think it's called. So what they've done, they've used this compound, they've injected this into squirrels, and they've put them into a state of hibernation during the summer. Now, of course, squirrels, they hibernate during the winter, and which is why they did this study, because they wanted to see if they could actually modify the hibernation period in squirrels. They were successful in that, so what they're doing now is to try and apply this DADL hormone to human cells, and what they've done, they've actually got these human cells to divide more slowly when they've applied this hormone, so that gives us an indication that this hormone may be this hibernation induction trigger. Obviously, they need to do more tests, and they're also testing more compounds such as dobutamine and insulin growth factor, which is something that helps us grow. Dobutamine is something usually administered to bedridden patients to strengthen the heart muscles. But in the case of hibernating astronauts, we'd actually use this to maintain their health, because obviously they would be inactive. Like the last caller said, what would we do to maintain the bone structure and the muscle? Well, we'd inject this dobutamine into them. So there'd be two hormones. It would be the hibernation induction trigger, which would put them to sleep, and then it would be the insulin growth factor. It would help them maintain their health during the long period of inactivity.
So you would really have to rely on automation to be flawless for all of this. I mean, it would be at a much higher level of redundancy and confidence than what we have even today, I would think.
Well, you would, but there's a way around that. Like the film that I mentioned, Pandorum, they had crews on two-year rotations, so there'd always be a human crew awake. 2 years, and then at the end of those 2 years, that crew would go into hibernation. Another crew would wake up and take over. So you could do that on a mission that every few months a crew rotation would wake up, and then it would go back to the hibernated state.
So you'd have two crews. One is always asleep when the other one is awake and working.
Well, you could have five or six crews. I mean, say for example, you have 20 people on the crew, and you have split that into five teams. And you each do a rotation of, I don't know, 2 or 3 months.
Okay, and so that is a safety factor if the automation has a problem.
Well, that'd probably be the safest way, unless you have absolute faith in the artificial intelligence, which most humans wouldn't.
Reasonably, how far out are we from having some of this technology operational?
I think the cell repair machines, the nanotech, is probably closer to realization than hibernation. I mean, I think the nanotech, those cell repair machines, we're probably going to see that in the next 4 to 5 years. Hibernation, we're probably looking at probably another 10 or 15.
So you're made the head of the space at SAR, and they tell you, get us ready for a manned mission to Mars. What's the date that you're going to schedule it when we can be ready to go, including hardware, financing, technology, and medical? So given what you've been talking about, what do you think is the more realistic date from right now today to when we could launch a human mission to Mars?
Well, assuming Franklin Chan Diaz's Vladimir is tested on ISS in 2014, which it's supposed to be, and assuming they can upgrade that to, assuming they can make a bigger version of that, then I would say in 2025 we're going to be able to get to Mars in 5 weeks, because that is solid technology. It's been developed over 3 decades. It's soon going to prove itself in low Earth orbit, and I think that's probably the way we're going to get to Mars, is using Vladimir and not conventional rocket technology.
Now, Zubrin kills Vladimir. I don't know if you've ever heard him offer his criticism. He takes no prisoners. On the other hand, if we actually had nuclear rocket propulsion, nuclear electric propulsion, we could get there really quickly as well, but there doesn't seem to be any real desire to do that.
And that's why I say Vladimir, because that has the heritage, the legacy. I mean, they've been investigating this and researching this for 3 decades. I think it was concept first came up in 1979, and it's come along in leaps and bounds, and it's solid technology.
I can't put words in Zubrin's mouth, but why he says it's a non-starter is because it requires in-space nuclear power generation so many times greater than anything that has ever been generated in space, and it's a huge problem, and it's just not going to happen to have that kind of nuclear power separately in space to fuel this thing. And if you really wanted to get there quickly, you could use nuclear propulsion that was created years ago, but all those programs have been quit, but they've been demonstrated, and they don't require huge reactors and power sources in space many, many times over what we've ever had in space. So that's, it's hard for me to do justice to anything Bob says, but that's the essence of his criticism. He doesn't really think that nuclear power is necessary, but it would absolutely shorten the mission and make things easier from that perspective. If we didn't have nuclear, and since it's such a dirty word, and we're going to go there with chemical rocket propulsion with people, that 2025 date, what does that move out to?
Well, it depends if we have if we leave it in the hands of the government, or if we allow commercial enterprise to go. Because SpaceX, we know that SpaceX want to go to Mars sooner rather than later. So I would say there's probably good money on SpaceX embarking on a mission by 2030.
2030, and
if not sooner.
And if you leave it in the government, it may never happen. Who knows?
Well, that's it.
You know, so hard to estimate for what we can do with a government project. We're at the top of the hour, time for our second and last break in our 90-minute segment. So listeners, again, the phone line, 1-866-687-7223. Back in 3 minutes, talking more with Eric Seedhouse about his new book, Trailblazing Medicine. Be right back.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. We're talking today to Eric Seathouse. His new book, which I highly recommend, Trailblazing Medicine, Sustaining Explorers During Interplanetary Missions, is available. It's a Springer Praxis book. And, Eric, you have a caller on the line. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
This is John, Atlanta, again.
Yeah.
The talk about Vastomir just kind of got my ears up a little bit. I had to get into this. I think the thing you have to realize about Zubrin's attitude on it is the fact that he's looking at a very near-term mission to Mars, and in this decade, if possible. He's saying, and obviously I don't think a fully developed Vastomir system would be ready in that time frame. And he's absolutely right that you do need a revolutionary space nuclear power system to make the thing really to where you can get to Mars in weeks or that sort of thing. You know, it's not an impossible development, but it would be something that we have that's never been done before. And perhaps using, you know, later generation nuclear technologies almost, because the trick is obviously it has to operate a very high temperature cycle, because you have to, your waste heat has to go out in a radiated form, and that's done by the fourth power of the temperature in absolute, you know, Kelvin terms. So it's a, you know, you're gonna have to have a probably like operate 1,000 degrees on the down cycle of this thing in Kelvin.
Yeah. You heard Zubrin go ballistic about that.
Yeah. But it doesn't support his idea of getting to Mars in 2019 or something. You know, I mean.
Well, yeah.
It'd take time to develop this the power system and to, you know, scale up Vastomir to that level of performance.
Well, he would be attacking Eric as one of those aerospace medicine doctors that just want to study.
That's true.
You know, that you heard.
I just want to say that longer term, if you're, you know, have a positive, you know, aggressive interplanetary space program, I think that Vastomir does have tremendous promise. That's my point. But it would be the level where we're prepared to go nuclear in space. And, you know, if we're not prepared to do that, then you could do solar versions for, you know, orbital corrections or, you know, that kind of thing. But
You know, I think we have a lot of fears to get over before we're going to go nuclear in space.
Well, that's probably true.
Unless Russia or China does it, because I don't think that they're bogged down the same way we are.
Yeah. Russians could conceivably do it.
Eric, any comments to what John is saying?
No, I think I'd still put my money on SpaceX in terms of being the first people to go there.
My money goes on SpaceX, too, and I can imagine the pressure, because they probably know that everybody's putting their money on them right now. So they're the game in town, and they're the ones that have to move us forward. It's really on their shoulders, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think commercial space is the way it's going to go. I mean, that's why I joined Astronauts for Hire. That's why I work for those guys, because...
I didn't know you had joined Astronauts for Hire.
Well, I'm their training director. I've been their training director for just over a year now, so I've developed their training plans, qualification plans, and we've got a whole bunch of our guys doing their astronaut training as we speak. At NASA, doing their centrifuge training, their hyperbaric training. Some of them are doing their survival training at the end of this month, and then they're going to survival systems to do their emergency egress training. So a few more qualified astronauts come September.
Have you ever done astronauts for hire? I mean, NASTAR's training?
Well, I don't need to because I have my own centrifuge. I'm a training director for...
Whoa. You have your own centrifuge, Eric?
Well, I'm in charge of centrifuge operations for Canadian Forces pilots. So I actually operate the centrifuge. So anytime I want to sit in the centrifuge, I can put myself in there and they can spin me to 6 or 7G or whatever
I
want to.
Can I come up there and will you spin me?
Well, that's the problem. It's a military installation, so we can only spin military personnel.
I was in the Navy way back when I was young. Does that count?
Well, we can get you in a hyperbaric chamber, but not a centrifuge, I'm afraid.
I'm not sure I could take a centrifuge, but because I get dizzy problems, but I would love to try it.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, as long as you don't puke or black out, right?
Well, actually, no. I've only ever seen one case of motion sickness from the centrifuge. I've seen plenty of people black out. Lots of gravity induced loss of consciousness, but that's because they don't do what we told them to do. Usually, that's pilot for you.
I just want to be in one, and hopefully it doesn't go haywire like James Bond. Was that in Moonraker where they set the, you know, deactivated the kill switch and, you know, he almost, you know, got flattened out?
Well, back in the 60s, NASA was so concerned about the G-forces that the astronauts spent 45 hours centrifuge training. 45 hours. And the cosmonauts, for Soyuz back in the 60s, they had to do 12G unprotected. That's without a G-suit. Right now, to put that in perspective, a Canadian Forces pilot has to sustain 7G for 15 seconds. That's it. Back in those days, the cosmonauts had to sustain 12G with nothing. They were tough.
12G?
12G.
Jesus.
That's incredible.
So that would actually be 12 times my weight, right?
That's right. So you imagine flying supine in the Soyuz. At that, with those G-forces, you couldn't actually reach up and touch the control panel if there was an emergency, because your arm would weigh too much.
Well,
too much to do it.
I am not going to even say on air what 12 times my weight would be, but let me say it might be approaching a baby elephant.
Well, that's what it feels like.
I can well imagine. Do you know that in the days of the Salem witches, one of the ways they killed the witches was to pile stones on them until they died? I don't mean stoning them by throwing them like they do in the Islamic world. I mean they just laid them down in a pit and kept putting heavy stones on them until the pressure suffocated them or, you know, caused them to not be able to breathe anymore or whatever the medical things was. So I can't imagine that equaled 12 G's.
Well, there were occasions of cracked ribs. They did have problems like that.
Well, wouldn't you have a cracked rib with 12 G's?
Not necessarily, no. Not if you're doing a good anti-G strain maneuver.
John, do you have any more questions?
That'd be it.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Again, listeners, the line is available, 1-866-687-7223. You know, I've been doing the space show for more than 10 years now, Eric, and I have been doing aerospace medicine shows probably since the first year of doing the space show. And to one degree or another, we comprehensively discuss these issues. Some guests are better and some are, you know, just touching on the issue, and there's a few that blow it out. But here's the point. In the 10 years that I have been doing this show, whatever progress has been made and has been reported in the terms of a conference paper or this or that or the other, we still have all these problems and challenges. What the hell is wrong that we can't, in 10 years, knowing about these problems, can't really make sizable progress in mitigating them?
Well, they're pretty big problems.
Well, I understand that, but are we just not spending enough money? Do we need national policy to you know, make them get the attention they need? Do we need higher quality research? Do we actually need to say we have to be able to mitigate these by 2019 because Zubrin's Mars Express is launching on December 15th of that year? I mean, what do we need to start saying we can resolve some of these issues?
Well, you need a goal first. I mean, the goal drives the mission. The mission drives the research, because right now there's no coordinated effort.
Well, you can say that.
There's research going on here, there, and everywhere. I mean, in the United States and with the European Space Agency. But, I mean, it's piecemeal. It's not coordinated because we don't have a destination to go to. So if somebody came up tomorrow and said, right, we have to go to Mars by 2019, then you'd see a completely different landscape.
Okay, so we had the vision for space exploration, and we were going to go to the moon by, what, 2020, and then it started slipping. But that was a goal, and we didn't do anything about that in the 6 or 7 years since President Bush, what, in 2004, made the VSE announcement.
There was more research going on in radiation and bone demineralization in those years. I mean, they didn't solve the problems, but there was more research.
So it did increase.
It did increase, yeah. I mean, I've been to the Aerospace Medical Conference, and it goes in waves. I mean, during VSE, there was definitely more research in radiation and bone demineralization, and when that was canceled, it dropped off.
Okay, so then what do you say to the folks, and you've heard them and met them and talked to them, who say we need no destinations, what we should be doing is concentrating on research and development. So you're sort of suggesting, I think I hear from you, is that we need a goal, and goals should include a destination and a timeline.
Well, yes, that would drive the research. Having said that, I'm not one for doing research for research sake. I mean, turning back the clock 100 years, looking at the golden age of exploration, those explorers went into the unknown. They took huge risks. And I think what we know now, we know what the risks are. I think there's still a case for manning an expedition to go to Mars and just taking those risks. I think that's what's going to happen with SpaceX.
Okay, so the one-way mission to Mars, does that make sense to you?
Well, I wouldn't sign up for that, but, I mean, I know people who would. I mean, if you go back to the pilgrims on the Mayflower, they didn't sit around Plymouth Rock waiting for a return trip. They came to settle, and there's an argument that can be made, and it's an argument that Buzz Aldrin made back in, I think, a year ago in Vanity Fair, that when you go to Mars, you make the decision to go there permanently.
Well, and you have to be able to figure out how to have air and water at a minimum, plus food. I mean, the people coming to, on the Mayflower didn't have to worry about bringing air and water with them and an abundant food because they knew they could get food and hunt and kill and fish on the other side, assuming they didn't fall off a flat Earth or something. But, going to Mars, you're going to have to be able to have air, food, and water.
Well, that's it. I mean, the problem with recruiting people for a one-way trip, it's overcoming the mentality that a mission is only over when the astronauts get back on Earth. But that isn't necessarily the case, or it doesn't have to be. A one-way mission could be part of a long-term plan. I mean, you could send them there with plenty of life support systems and consumables and say, look, there'll be some more people along in a few months or a few years.
Fascinating. So let me give you this question, and this is from Kelly, and Kelly is in Boston. And Kelly says, given the state of our current space policy, the situation with the United States budget, and the proposed Congressional Fiscal Year 12 budget cuts that were announced last week in the House subcommittee, what is your own personal forecast for moving forward in solving some of these problems and in having a space policy that takes us someplace meaningful in a relatively near-term future, let's say out to 20 years?
Well, out to 20 years, if I was looking for a destination, then I guess it would have to be Mars. I don't see, I really don't see the potential of going to a near-Earth asteroid or near-Earth object as a destination that would inspire people. I just don't think people will be inspired by a mission like that. Mars has always been in the media. People know a lot about Mars. It's something that would inspire people, I think. And I think that would be something that would drive the research and would reinvigorate the space industry, not just the government industry, but also also provide more impetus in the commercial industry as well.
I guess Kelly's also asking if you see our financial and policy, weak policy and weak leadership issues, economic issues, today as a serious roadblock to our future? I think that's part of what Kelly was asking.
Well, I think that just the policy is a reflection of the lack of a desire to explore, and I think that's quite sad, really, because not having that, you don't inspire future generations, and you don't really have anywhere to go.
Peggy is in New York State. Peggy says, "I'm one of those who believe that if we had a serious humans to Mars mission, be it American or be it international, it would change the emotional climate of the entire world, and specifically those countries involved in putting the mission together, even if the goal date or the deadline started to slip. I'm also starting to think that governments don't want this, because such a mission, such an inspiration, such a uniting behind a project of people all around the world would overpower what governments would rather have in terms of their own power over people." I don't know if you want to comment on this, and David, I don't know if you want to read this on air, but I'm really beginning to see that something like an inspiring manned mission to Mars overrides the objectives of many governments, including our own, and that is why we're not seeing goals like a manned mission to Mars.
Well, part of the reason we're not seeing manned missions to Mars sponsored by governments is because of the risk, and no government wants to authorize a mission where there are so many risks. And we've talked about those risks over the last hour or so, and you imagine the people who sign off on that bill to approve the funds for such a mission, and then if somebody dies on that mission, or if that mission is aborted or failed completely and you have a loss of crew or a loss of mission, then they have to be accountable for that. And no government wants to be accountable for such a risky mission, which is why I think SpaceX is going to be the one to get us there, or some commercial consortium. Right now, it's just too risky.
Well, we talked earlier about rules for pregnancy and preemptive surgery and stuff like that, but we didn't talk about bioethical rules. If a crew member dies, and what do you do with the remains? Do you find a way to bring them back? Do you jettison them in space a la Star Trek? I guess if you're talking about a 3-year mission to Mars, you absolutely have to consider the possibility that one or more crew members might die on the mission.
Well, that's right. I mean, what happens if somebody is seriously ill and they're using life support consumables? If they're terminally ill, they're going to die anyway. You have to euthanize them because they're using life support consumables that could otherwise be used by the crew. Who takes that decision? The commander. Is it fair? No. What happens if the family back on Earth wants the body for burial back on Earth? That's not going to happen because no crew would want to keep a dead body on a spacecraft going to Mars and back.
Well, you'd have to refrigerate it or something. I mean, think of the resources it would take up.
Well, that's right. So there'd have to be some guidelines for burial in space. And I don't know what those would be. Maybe they'd be similar for burial at sea. I don't know. But those guidelines haven't been written yet. Again, imagine Fox News. What would Fox News say when NASA decides to euthanize one of its crew members? It'd be all over the page, all over the news pages.
Well, all the news services would go ballistic with that.
Well, that's right, but that's what you'd have to do.
And
what
then,
about giving the crew member an option to euthanize himself?
And then
self-sacrifice.
Congress would start holding hearings.
Well, that's right, but that's what you'd have to do.
And then the Justice Department, upon return of the crew, might investigate the captain of the crew or whatever for committing murder or something. I don't know. I mean, there's so many wacky things that happen now where you would never think that they would happen, you know, with government reaction to this or that. I think, you know, if government seriously thinks about all of these issues, they probably would say, we don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole.
That's it. It's a public relations nightmare.
And see, I think in terms of what Peggy is talking about, I think you're more in line that if they really start thinking about what they're going to have to do for rules and protocols and all of this, they're not going to want to take the heat for some really tough decisions that might have to be made by commanders representing the nation.
That's it. It's a public relations nightmare that they don't want to touch.
Even if the people have signed away their rights and said you can bury me in space and you can euthanize me and all of that, wow, big issues to face, right?
And that's why I tried to come up with some sort of bioethics manual, just a tongue-in-cheek attempt at writing one, and I put that as an appendix at the back of the book.
You have it in there, but then, and I guess if you're a crew member and you absolutely want to be resuscitated and you don't want to do this, you're not qualified to go.
You're not going to go, no.
So now do they hit you for discrimination?
Well, it comes back to that waiving of individual rights. The same with genetic testing. You sign on or you don't sign on. It's as simple as that.
Do you think this would be the same for a crew going to a lunar habitat? Do you think we'd be facing the same issues given that it's so much closer to Earth?
Probably not as serious, but I mean, you still have the same issues. Sooner or later, something bad is going to happen. Sooner or later, somebody is going to die in space. Sooner or later, somebody is going to have a terminal illness in space. Sooner or later, somebody is going to get injured. I mean, it's going to happen. And right now, we don't have a guideline for burial in space, as far as I don't know. And so if somebody does die, God forbid, on the International Space Station, then, okay, what do we do? Do we put them in the Soyuz life? I'm guessing we just put them in the Soyuz lifeboat and they come back to Earth. But to the moon, what do we do there? Do we bury them on the moon?
I don't know. Do you know if there's anyone in NASA? Is there a group that is actually doing a bioethics manual along these lines? Do you know if that's really being put together in some way or another?
Yeah, there is. I can't remember his name, but 2 years ago, NASA appointed a bioethics director. That's all he does. I can't remember his name.
If you remember it, I'd like to see if he'd come on the show and talk frankly with us, but he may not.
Well, that would be interesting.
Yeah, if you can remember his name, or I'll do a Google search for it and see if I can find it.
Well, I'm probably even trying to think.
Maybe that would be interesting.
Paul Volpe, I think. Volpe. W-O-L-P-E. That's his name.
Okay. Do you think, let me give you, because we're coming up on the end of the show, let me give you the last question from a listener. Jane, Albuquerque, New Mexico. To fly an airplane, there are different classes of medical certificates that the would-be pilot can get. Do you think that when we are going to Mars or something like that, there might be different kinds of classes of medical approval for the crew or the passenger, and depending upon what your job may be or the mission may be, you might be qualified for this but not that, but therefore you could still go on the mission? Could we see classifications that allow different shapes of people to be on a Mars mission, for example?
As long as we solve all these problems, then that's going to be the case. It's solving these problems first. I mean, without the radiation problem, without the bone demineralization problem, then obviously that will open the selection to a lot more people, or the inclusion to a lot more people. But right now, the next few Mars missions, whenever they happen, it's going to be quite a selective medical qualification.
One more quick email came in from Perry in Salt Lake City. Do you think that there's a room for genetic modification, which I've heard others on David's show talk about? Is that something that is plausible, and plausible in the near term meaning maybe within now and 10 years?
Well, that's possible. You can make, you can genetically engineer somebody to be more radiation resistant. You can genetically engineer them to have greater bone density. I would say probably the next best thing would be human cloning. So rather than send us off into a Mars mission, then we just clone somebody and send them off to do the job. I mean, if you're a fan of science fiction, you'll remember the movie Moon. That's how mining is done on the moon. In that film, it's done by a clone. So why not send clones?
What book is next for you?
Well, I've just written one called Interplanetary Outpost, which is basically how we get to destinations beyond Mars, so to Titan and Saturn and Jupiter.
When does that come out?
It comes out on September the 1st.
Do you want to come back on the show and talk about it?
Yeah, I'd love to, yeah.
Who's publishing that one?
Same publisher.
Springer Praxis?
That's it, yeah.
Okay, I'll email you the first of the week some dates and let's schedule it. That sounds like it'd be a real interesting book, and I'd like to read that as well as share it with the listeners.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, definitely.
Closing comments, do you give out an email address for people who want to ask you questions directly rather than posting on the blog?
I think just go to, the Hotmail one that I gave you.
The which one you gave me?
The Hotmail, Dr. Eric.
Oh, the Hotmail address. Okay, I can list that. Any closing comments, pearls of wisdom you'd like to leave us?
Well, no, just that some of the science that we're looking at is it seems quite daunting trying to resolve the problems of radiation and bone demineralization, but it's being done. In the research is being done. It will be resolved soon, hopefully. And what we've talked about may sound like science fiction, but as so often happens in life, science fiction has a habit of becoming fact, and I think that's really the essence of this book. Those problems that we've talked about will be resolved, and hopefully sooner rather than later we'll be on these missions that we've been talking about.
You got an email comment in the 11th hour here from another listener, John. I don't think burial in space would be that big of a problem for the astronauts, but the euthanasia work is a bigger PR issue-wise and probably would be a big problem. Boy, I can see the headlines on that, right?
Well, Fox News.
I can just see how they would play that out, and then Charlie Rose will do a special, and on and on and on. It'll never end. Eric, this is great. Listeners, if you really want to understand these issues, rather than listen to the huff and puff and rhetoric of what various space enthusiasts, blow out and they're not knowledgeable about it, this is a great book to read. It is not a medical textbook. You can easily handle it. It's about 175 pages, and I totally recommend it. Trailblazing Medicine, Sustaining Explorers During Interplanetary Mission, and it also has the history in it of many of these early expeditions that Eric has been talking about today and then extrapolating back into space. I wish I could still sell them through the space show, but the state of California has made that an impossibility. So just go check it out at your favorite bookstore or online bookstore, and you'll be able to get it. Eric, thanks a lot. I look forward to talking to you next quarter on your other book that you mentioned.
And
listeners, that's it. Come back. We have a full week on the space show. The website newsletter will be posted right after this show, and look forward to hearing from all of you during the week. And again, thanks, Eric, for a great book and a good discussion.
Thanks again.
Okay, and on behalf of Eric Seedhouse and the Space Show, goodbye, everyone.